Prime ministers
and presidents
may come and go, but the certainty of exemplary entertainment on the Midweek Drive
and the Midweek Drive Morning Edition
remains.
In every job that must be done, there is an element of fun. You find the fun, and snap! The job's a game. And every task you undertake becomes a piece of cake, a lark, a spree. It's very clear to see that a spoonful of sugar helps the medicine go down, the medicine go down, medicine go down. Just a spoonful of sugar helps the medicine go down in a most delightful way. A robin feathering his nest has very little time to rest while gathering his bits of twine and twig. Though quite intent in his pursuit, he has a merry tune to toot. He knows a song will move the job along. Sugar helps the medicine go down, the medicine go down, medicine go down. Just a spoonful of sugar helps the medicine go down in a most delightful way. The nectar from the flowers to the comb never tire of ever buzzing to and fro, because they take a little nip from every flower that they sip, and hence they find their task is not a
carnage. That's what it's all about. Absolute carnage. Thankfully, Giorgia has left Italy. No, we're referring to Giorgia Scotto di Risato. Giorgia, good to connect with your good self. Welcome to what we kind of loosely call Movies and Royals. It fits on to the Midweek Drive Morning Edition. And it is your first experience of a Zoom session, which used to be in the studio, but welcome to the whole joy of Siren Radio. How are you? I'm not sure whether you've muted yourself, but anyway, Natasha Armstrong has just joined us, and I'm sure she's very well, because without any further ado, We simply have to actually change the background, change all sorts of other bits and pieces, and move from the sheer wonderment of carnage to saying those words. Happy birthday, Natasha Armstrong. Yes, indeed, it is your birthday. Has it been a good day, Natasha?
Thank you. We sort of made the best of it in terms of lockdown. We sort of pulled all the furniture back and had a bit of a picnic in the living room. And yeah, it was really nice. Sun came out. So for our prescribed exercise, got to take the dog for a bit of a walk. So luxury nowadays. It was a good day.
It just shows that a picnic. I mean, it's wonderful. You'll be making sort of blanket castles next, which is truly wonderful and just what we actually need. So well done. Now, Natasha, you are still in lockdown. You're in Australia. You're in Melbourne, Australia, obviously, from that point of view. Georgia, hopefully your microphone is now working. You've just been forced back into isolation because, unfortunately, you attended a lecture at the University of Lincoln where somebody has actually sort of tested positive. So what can I say? I know you're all set to actually watch all sorts of movies for this one. How are you, Georgia?
I'm fine. It's quite difficult because I've isolated lots of times, but it's fine. It's just over 20 seconds. So as soon as I get out, I will go and watch Dune and Venom 2 at the cinema.
Yeah, that's what we like to see. So you're getting ready, because I know you're all set to actually talk about Carnage, but sadly, presumably you weren't able to go to the cinema. You couldn't even leave your base to actually sort of envisage the joys of Eddie Brock and the whole Carnage film. I take that as a no. Excellent.
Well, I did some research.
This is what we like to hear. We'll see just how much research you've done, because somebody always does research. And probably, Katie, you could explain to Richard how he can set himself so that, like yourself, you're kind of virtual. We thought we'd sorted it out with Richard last week. Tragically,
Alex, when it's live, we don't discuss these things.
Oh, Richard, it's production meetings on air, as Phil Lears would say. Anyway, Katie, welcome along. How are you?
Yeah, I'm really good. Just getting on with the piano. I got my exam in November, my initial grade. And then I had like a hectic few weeks, because it was my birthday. So that was fun.
You see, you have your birthday just a few days before Natasha has her birthday, because it is Natasha Armstrong's birthday today. And can I ask us all, that's Robin, Richard, Georgia and Katie, to actually formally join me in saying, happy birthday, Natasha, after three.
Happy birthday, Natasha.
Happy birthday, Natasha.
Happy birthday, Natasha.
Or, in character, good day and happy birthday, mate.
good Australian reference there. Robin, go Carnage. Talk to us about it, please.
Go Carnage. Okay. Well, this is the follow-up to the Venom movie of a couple of years ago. Now, Venom, for those who don't know, is actually one of Spider-Man's most dangerous enemies. The alien symbiote has basically joined with Eddie Brock, having been rejected by Peter Parker in the comic book universe. And so Venom is one of the very few villains to actually know Peter Parker's secret identity from his very origin appearance. In the films, it's very different. The first one set everything up and left us with a tantalizing look at a villain called Carnage in the form of Woody Harrelson as Cletus Kasady. Now, there are two symbiotes in this, so it's everything is bigger, everything is louder, the effects are absolutely spot on. It does not necessarily mean that everything is better. Woody Harrelson brings a manic, psychotic energy to the character of Carnage. Well, the way Carnage comes about is that Cletus is a very dangerous prisoner about to be executed, and he's promised Eddie Brock, Venom, an interview to tell him all his secrets. And he kind of flips and bites Eddie right on the arm, drawing blood. So some of the symbiote fluid in Eddie's blood gets into Cletus, and he becomes a red symbiote, the most dangerous of them all, calling himself Carnage. Now, I had been looking forward to this film for such a long time. And I saw two films yesterday, and surprisingly enough, this was not the better one I saw. More on the other one in a few minutes. Visually, this is a real treat, and it really is like the comic book come to life. The performances are uniformly, absolutely what you would expect. What is missing is it's not epic. It's not the big event. The main duel between the two takes place in a deserted church, and it's all a little bit Daredevil and Spawn. And I wanted more. I wanted bigger. I wanted more scale to it. And
you got 90 minutes, Robin. What more do you want?
The story's too sort of localized, too small, too intimate. And I realized that what the film really needed, it does need Spider-Man. You need a superhero in there because they've reduced Venom, this highly dangerous, psychotic villain, to basically a one-man Morecambe and Wise who's comically...
But you get lots of laughs, Robin. That's what you want. You want cheering up, don't you?
He's not supposed to be funny. Oh. Now, you can get away with that to a degree, but when your whole film is based on that, and the jokey, oh, I'm going to eat him. Oh, no, you're not. Oh, yes, I'm going, you know.
It's like Steve Martin and Lily Tomlin in All of Me. That's all you want, and that's what we need in the world today.
No, we need proper Venom being dangerous. We've got... Carnage now. We need a Spider-Man in the middle there, and well, there is a Sting which promises a tantalizing resolution to my dilemma with this. The second film I saw was Halloween Kills, and I'm thinking, it's the 12th installment. Okay, it's a new continuity. Let's go and see this. And you know what? It was absolutely brilliant. It takes place on the same night as the previous film, which is a direct sequel to the events of 40 years ago. They bring back a couple of the child actors from the original film, the original sheriff, people, you know, the little girl who Laurie Strode was babysitting back in 1978.
Okay, let's hold it there, Robin. Let's hold it there briefly, because I don't want to actually let Venom just go completely. Natasha, Venom, is it one that you're likely to be wanting to download or watch or catch, or is it one which you'd actually say, well, if Robin didn't like it, I don't know if I will.
I'm not saying I didn't like it. I'm saying I expected an 8.
Robin, happy DC Fandom Day. Happy DC Fandom Day. Content yourself with the newly released Matt Reeve Batman video and ident and trailer. Natasha.
I was actually quite surprised by the first Venom movie. I initially didn't see it in the cinema. I sort of waited until I watched it on telly. Because I was worried, kind of like Robin, that maybe it would need Spider-Man in it. Would it work with it just being standalone? But I actually rather enjoyed the first one. So it's interesting hearing Robin's comments about the second one, feeling that he needs sort of hero in this one. So I'm definitely going to watch it. It'll be interesting to see how his comments relate to it. Yeah,
got to keep the Sony or Sony franchise going. Interesting that Robin is diametrically opposed to Mark Kermode, who didn't like the first movie, loved the second. Katie, have you seen either?
I haven't, no, but is it Tom Hardy who plays Venom?
Yes, it is.
Yeah, I think what's interesting, Robin, is you said it's more like intimate. And I think for me, because I don't really watch superhero films, that would probably work for me personally, because in the past when I've watched them, because I don't watch them normally, I find that I don't really understand what's going on. So, yeah, I think I do want to watch it. I'd have to watch the first one, though, as well. But I do like Tom Hardy. I think he's a fantastic actor.
Who knows? Maybe another James Bond, or maybe not. Georgia, you were going to see Venom 2 last night. Have you seen Venom 1? Has this put you off? Is it a case of, no, I'm waiting now to be released on the 22nd of October, and then I can go straight away and see Dune?
Well, I've already watched you, and I would go to watch you for a second time because in Italy it was released earlier because of a Venice festival. So I've already watched that.
Nice.
But yeah, I could probably watch Venom. Based on the reviews I read, I'm not very happy with it. I think a lot of scenes were cut, and I think maybe it was too short. And was it maybe just like a transition to bring Venom into the Marvel Universe? Because it seems like people are more now focused on what's happened in the post-credit scene than in the whole movie. So was it just like a transition to bring Venom in Spider-Man world and the other superheroes?
You see, Robin, you should listen to Georgia. She knows of what she speaks. Venice Film Festival. That's what it's all about. I'm not sure if Richard Fitzwilliam's gone there. Good news, Richard. I've worked some magic at this end, so we have your wonderful image, which is right side up. It's not moving, but at least your photograph is right side up. So good
That's
stuff.
That's very kind of you to tell me, Alex. Also, in detail on air, your statistic streak is not only evident, but very, very...
It's all down to Rashomon. It's all
my
down
venom,
to...
The venom I feel toward you is intense at the moment, I can tell you that. But I'm
it will be carnage.
This movie, I mean, fair enough, it's had a lot of publicity. I hope a lot of people who like this sort of thing go to see it, but it certainly will not include me. It never would have, to be fair, and it's not my sort of film. But having said that, at the moment, we're, you know, cinema isn't, as we all know, in an easy situation. And from that point of view, we want to encourage everybody to see what they like and also see it on the large screen. So, you know, I hope others go.
Well, we certainly would also wish all the very best for Louis Savvy, whose Sci-Fi London Film Festival is back live in the next few days. Sadly, again, I can't make it because it's the totally the wrong time of year to actually have anything like film festivals on there. Does he not realise we're actually having to coordinate all sorts of things here? It's a bit like Rashomon. Rashomon, the word of the day. Do you know what Rashomon actually reflects, Natasha?
I believe you're about to tell me the answer.
Well, yeah, as opposed to Rassilon. Rashomon, the same story told from multiple perspectives, multiple viewpoints. The sort of thing you get with Adam Driver. Or indeed, Ben Affleck and the Mullet from Hell and the Minstrel and probably other fine folk in Ridley Scott's attempt to get an Oscar. He's still trying to actually go for The Last Duel. Richard, your cue.
Well, I just have to say, firstly, that I am absolutely fascinated by epics. I was a child when I saw Ben-Hur, and it's odd, the genre's always intrigued me, the fact that you can, it's rather, cinema is after all, I mean, a dream factory, and the facts are that you can, especially with CGI, which is incredible in this movie, you can recreate past worlds, and Ridley Scott's done it in ancient Rome with Gladiator, with the Crusades, with Kingdom of Heaven, with ancient Egypt, with Exodus Gods and Kings, of course, in space. We've had Alien, and of course he did Blade Runner, and now he has chosen 14th century France. Now, this is obviously a big gamble. It's a tremendously expensive movie. And
Richard, I will just briefly interject by saying I do need to alert Natasha, as well as it being her birthday, that after this sequence, Robin and Richard will both be actually fighting a gladiatorial duel, and the winner will effectively, obviously, take over your entire rights and property. So no many spoilers there, but it's just a thought. Richard, back to you.
Well, it's also just the thought that whilst we are fighting, one of us will be supporting her and the other one will be opposing, and she will be shackled. And if the one who supports her loses, she will be tortured and burnt at the stake. And that actually is
So just like being in lockdown Melbourne then, Natasha.
I will just point out here that I will be supporting Natasha, and from my time working as a custodian in the castle, I am well used to using flail, mace, broadsword, and bow and arrow because I use them all.
But what about a lance? That's what you need, Robin, you see, so I'm afraid you're unprepared.
I don't do horses. I don't do horses. I don't like animals that are bigger than I am.
Well, there you have it. You see, this has got a tournament, and in fact, it begins with an incredible shot of the climactic duel, the last, this was the last one that ever was fought in France in 1386. And you, as I say, it's a dramatic opening, an aerial shot of this build-up, the last occasion where you had a trial by combat, and the tournament's held in Paris. We see the contestants briefly. Sir Jean de Carouge, Matt Damon plays him, and his erstwhile friend and squire Jacques Le Gris, played by Adam Driver. They clash on horseback, and then we see the story behind this, what actually led up to it. And this is based on real events. What is interesting, and which is why Alex referred to Kurosawa's Rashomon, is that it's seen this, we see the story from three perspectives: that from de Carouge, that from Le Gris, and that of the very courageous woman who was behind a case which became a cause célèbre in France. De Carouge's wife, Marguerite, whilst de Carouge was fighting with the French in Scotland, she claimed she was raised by Le Gris when alone in her castle, and she absolutely insists, as is her right, on justice. Now, this involves, putting it mildly, interrogations and the most horrible punishments, as I pointed out, if her champion, who has to be a husband, actually loses the trial by combat which the king decrees. We have three superb performances here. They give a very ingenious narrative, a dramatic intensity. So it's increasingly heightened as you near the bloody climax, because when you have a trial by combat, when the characters are unhorsed, no spoilers, but it is, putting it mildly, very dramatic and very violent. Matt Damon's de Carouge, he marries Marguerite because he's bankrupt. Her father has money. He's courageous in battle, to be sure, but he's an illiterate, he's boorish, he's temperamental, he's vain, incredibly vain. He makes enemies easily. Very typical type of knight, I'd have thought, at that time. A very convincing portrayal. And it's interesting also that Ben Affleck, who plays an aristocrat to whom he swears fealty, and he wrote the script, or co-wrote the script, and Nicole Harlofsener wrote the point of view from Marguerite that we see in this film from Marguerite. It's the first time they've written a script together since their Oscar-winning Good Will Hunting, and it is a very good script. And opposite, you've got Adam Driver, very, very different type of character as Le Gris. He's clever, he's a ruthless schemer, he manages to do his erstwhile friend out of firstly some land and then a position which his family had held. He's adroit at flattery. Now, he's very prone to self-deceit. Now, I do have to say, this is the one bit in the film that events from three perspectives that I do query, because he is so obsessed with Marguerite that he appears to believe that she consented when she so obviously did not. And since her husband is stupid enough perhaps to cherish such views, if he was the one, which he wasn't, he was away at the time.
It's Jodie Comer from Free Guy. I mean, what's not to appreciate?
I'm coming to her, but one bit of this film that I did feel that this character, who is so articulate, he's well-read, he's, I say, very much a schemer, for him to be obsessed with Marguerite is one thing, he undoubtedly was. But to believe that when she fights, when he rapes her, that she is also obsessed with him in some form, or that is a fantasy, and I didn't go that far. But having said that, a very good performance by Driver, a riveting depiction of a charismatic manipulator. And then you've got Jodie Comer, indeed, man, if you have, excellent as Marguerite, no rights as a woman in a feudal era, job simply to bear children, but she does ask for a fair hearing. Her husband, as I said, is her champion, and he doesn't even bother to tell her that if he loses, tortured, burnt at the stake for her, and if he wins, he gets the glory.
Or sent to Lincoln University, I don't know.
It could be almost as bad, Alex, almost as bad, yes. A split.
Yeah, people do survive it, though, as Katie and Natasha and Georgia will say. Is it, Richard, as Mark Kermode has actually said, a movie which somehow manages to be less than the sum of its parts?
No, I don't think so, because I'm just coming, if I may, to that. A very, very good performance, I thought, by Jodie Comer. Very good supporting cast, including Ben Affleck as the Bidness aristocrat and Harriet Walter as de Carouge's monstrous mother. She was raped. She's put up with it. The facts are it's a barbaric period. It's also in some ways beautiful. It's also in some ways fascinating. Now, the reason I think that this film is riveting isn't just the excellence of the performances and isn't just the way that the story is told, which is very unusual, but the way Scott recreates the period, the action, the battle scenes, the visuals, the music, the thrilling tournament, and also the way that the script, I think, works extremely well. So I was very, very impressed by this film. I do like epics. Ridley Scott had a dud with Robin Hood. But on the other hand, with Kingdom of Heaven and with Exodus, Gods and Kings, and above all with Gladiator, he showed that he can make a magnificent film. What this film is, though, it's got an 18 certificate. It is extremely violent. And Robbie Collin in the Telegraph has written an attack on the idea of this film and The Last Night in Soho as well, which I haven't seen, both getting 18, because, of course, that cuts out a huge audience. And I do have to say it's graphic, but I also have to say that it gives a very accurate portrayal of a period where women simply had absolutely no rights.
Were you there, Richard? Have you gone back in time? Do you know this for a fact?
I am. Well, if you look at the law, the law speaks for itself. And you also have fascinating scenes, which seem to me very realistic. So I rate this film very highly. I'd give it 8 to 9 out of 10. And the only reason that I would subtract anything is simply because you see the three sides to this. It was a great cause célèbre, as I mentioned, in France, but also it was thoroughly debated as to what actually happened. And I didn't feel that Legrisse, Adam Driver's character, would be quite so self-deluded as the film appears to think. But having said that, excellent performances all round, and I'm very, very sorry to report that the opening of this movie, and it's hard to find in London, quite honestly, in America, has been an absolute catastrophe. And that
it's two things, Richard: the minstrels, and of course, the mullet from hell. I rest my case. Natasha, has this tempted you to see The Last Duel?
My oh my, Richard, you are speaking my language tonight. I love historical epics. I absolutely adore them. So this is definitely up my alley. And it's the medieval period, which is like my favorite historical period. So yeah, ticking all the boxes, historical battles. Yep. Love it. Definitely would like to see.
Okay. Oh, great. I'm delighted. Please do see it. By the way, on the mayor said, please hit the wide screen while you can. It won't be on for long, I'm afraid.
Georgia, is it one for yourself or is it a case of, look, enough already?
No, it sounds very interesting. I wanted to go and watch it next week because I have an audio membership card. So every time a new movie comes out, I want to go and watch it. Also, I love Adam Driver and Ben Affleck. So I'm very interested to watch it. I'll probably do it when I'm out of isolation.
There you go. The Lincoln Odeon will be blessed by your presence. Katie, what about yourself? Heading off in Birmingham?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I do like historical epics. The only thing is it's the gore for me, but I suppose because of the era that it's set in, it is expected. But I am
but back in the day with Errol Flynn and Tony Curtis, you never had the kind of gore that Ridley Scott's putting together, which I think is just part and parcel. I mean, even Simon Mayo said,
hey, back in the days with Errol Flynn and Tony Curtis, you didn't have any realism either, did you?
I beg to differ. That's exactly how I remember the medieval period. Robin, given that you weren't able to see Venom in 4DX, the shaking cinema experience, which I gather people in London can actually go and have water thrown at them, steam coming up, and all of those wonderful tingler effects, which might have kind of coloured your impression of the movie. What about The Last Duel?
Well, Well, first of all, if you're going to throw water at me, you'd better be able to outrun me. Secondly, the last duel, Richard has done a far, far better job of selling me the idea of watching this movie than the trailer has. So I will be seeing it. I certainly not in the next week. Next week is Dune week for me, but I will be seeing it in some form somewhere. Whereas before hearing what Richard had to say, it was just a no.
Georgia, would you like to hear Richard talk about a musical with respect to Jamie, or would you like to hear Robin talk about Halloween, the movie? What would you like to go for?
Well, I do like trashy horror sometimes, so I'll be interested.
The vote goes to you, Robin. She likes trashy horror. Over to you.
Well, as I said, this was the film of the day for me, and I didn't see that coming, because my worst fear for this film was that it would be a placeholder, because we know that they've already set up that this particular sequence of films is going to be three, and it's going to finally end with the next Halloween, which is going to be released Halloween next year. So I thought this was going to be a placeholder with nowhere in particular to go. To a degree, I suppose I would agree with that. It picks up exactly where the last Halloween movie ended, with Laurie Strode, Jamie Lee Curtis's house in flames, Michael Myers, the killer, trapped inside. It all becomes very Bride of Frankenstein, if you've ever seen that film, where Michael Myers actually survives in the basement and works his way out and is on his way to kill more people. It all happens on the same night, except for a few flashbacks which go back to the original film. They've got an amazingly, it has to be CGI over an actor, a recreation of Donald Pleasance in his role of Dr. Loomis, which is absolutely convincing and makes the Peter Cushing reincarnation that they had in Rogue One kind of look like he belonged on the Clone Wars. This is absolutely convincing. It's the best recreation of a deceased actor in a film that I have seen. It does move the story forward. Jamie Lee Curtis has very little to do in it, really. It harks back a bit to Halloween 2, where there's a lot in happening in hospital. But it also kind of touches on, who are the real monsters here? Is it Michael Myers going around killing people? Or when Myers escaped from the asylum in the first film, a couple of other inmates went along with him, also escaping. Now, one of them ends up in the wrong place at the wrong time, and the mob think it's Michael Myers. And the way that they turn, and they turn in the hospital, chasing him, chasing this poor guy down, it all smacked very, very heavily of the scenes that we saw of the mob storming the Senate back in January, and how even Laurie Strode, the Jamie Lee Curtis character, says, "It's not him, it's not him." By that point, all reason has been lost. So, you know, we all can turn into monsters. It's there's a little bit of explanation there. Yeah, we are. There's a lot of explanation there and a filling in of what happened and how he was caught on the original Halloween night in 1978. And very cleverly, they've added film grain so that film actually looks a little bit older in the flashbacks. The one thing I will tell you is, if you haven't seen the original and you haven't seen the Halloween movie of a couple of years ago, don't go and see this, because you need that full background. You absolutely need it, because nothing will make sense to you. And whereas I gave Carnage a 6, I will give this one an 8. And I thought it would be the other way around. I'm as surprised as anybody.
It just goes to show. Okay, moments for passing so rapidly. Georgia, I'll turn to your good self. I know you're quite fascinated about Prince Charles going for cheese and wine for his car and various other things. You've been following that sort of system. Richard might like to speak a bit about that. Or
well,
would you
if
like
I could
to speak?
Just get in a review, Alex, of everyone one's talking about Jamie, because it's going
if
to be.
If you
very
must,
tight.
Richard, I would have gone Mary Poppins myself. But if you must go into
let's talk about Mary Poppins, because we haven't got very much time. I mean, the facts are that Mary Poppins was one of my fondest childhood memories, and that movie was the Disney classic, and it was interesting to also see that movie dealing with the background of it, starring Emma Thompson and Tom Hanks, also to see the way it was put on screen, and subsequently, of course, there's been Mary Poppins Returns, but I was fascinated to see what it was going to be like on stage, and I hadn't seen this terrific musical. I mean, if you want that, a child pleaser, this is the movie. I'm not saying that all adults will like all of it, but we all should be in touch with our inner child. It's directed by Richard Eyre, it's produced by Cameron McIntosh, and it has Zizi Strallen as the nanny who's practically perfect in every way and who arrives at Cherry Tree Lane in Queen Victoria's reign. The film was actually set in the Edwardian period. And purpose, the nanny to Jane and Michael Banks, but the real purpose is to save their father, because the children are very naughty and they have had terrible nannies, but nonetheless they know exactly what they want, whereas their father's all at sea, less so in the film, which I saw, as I say, when a child loved, when David Tomlinson made it an immortal George Banks, but nonetheless here we've got Banks as a very rundown character and reliant on Winifred, his wife. I have to say it's a very good cast. It's also got most of the favourite songs. It's also got a real amazing turn. There are a couple of spoilers I must avoid here, because as in the dancing and in some of the movements of the characters, you will get somewhat of a surprise. But to see Charlie Stemp as the Mary Poppins's friend Bert the chimney sweep, and how he dances, especially in the famous step in time routine, that is fantastic. How does Mary Poppins depart? Well, you can just imagine. It's a huge cast. It's a child's dream, really. The designs are colourful. Well, some of them are pretty hideous, in my opinion, but nonetheless, this is a tour de force. And what it also has, anyone with a heart, I think, would be touched by the appearance of the inimitable Petula Clark, who sings Feed the Birds, because this was part of the original movie, and it's an absolutely enchanting touch here. You've got some good performances, Charlie Anson, Amy Griffiths, and as I say, above all, Zizi Strallen, absolutely terrific as Mary Poppins, and Charlie Stemp can dance, in my opinion, in an absolutely amazing way. So this is colourful, it's fun, and the book is by Julian Fellowes, and rather extraordinarily and very audaciously, it's actually got some extra songs. So I thought they did pretty well, quite frankly. I mean, the whole thing is a 2.5-hour super colossal, super califragilistic expialidocious spectacular. And if you like this sort of thing and you've got kids and you want to give them some fun, for goodness sake, it is practically perfect in every way. It'd be a far too much of a spoonful of sugar for some people, and they wouldn't go. Those who did go were absolutely enthralled by it.
And Richard Fitzwilliams wins the award for trying to squeeze in as many Sherman Brothers songs as possible into his review there. We'll hear another one in a few seconds, and it's quite clearly going to be the obvious one. I just say, why go to London to actually see that? But it's on the stage, so you'd have to. Georgia, would that appeal to yourself? Mary Poppins, that is.
I like musicals. Yeah. Mary Poppins has never been my favourite musical, but I will go and watch it.
Mm. Katie?
I don't know, actually, because I like the original one.
Exactly. This is the whole point. You know, why? That's the. I mean, as Johnson said about the dog walking on his hind legs. Yeah, fine. But why? Natasha?
Yeah, if I'm given the opportunity, I'd probably go and see this.
You're not flying over from Australia because you're concerned about the carbon footprint, unlike the COP26 people, and probably Prince William, who's got his views on William Shatner completely wrong. But there we are. Katie, I know you like to flag up and like all of Richard's posts, and we'll continue to do so. Robin, Mary Poppins, is that one for you?
I like the film. I particularly like Saving Mr. Banks, the film. But, you know, I'm unlikely to travel across and down the country to
carbon footprint. To see this.
Carbon footprint, fuel costs.
Yeah, yeah.
But
exactly.
I will congratulate Richard on that stunning review, because I think it's the closest I've ever heard you come to just sheer hyperbole.
Yeah. Hyperbole and Richard Fitzwilliams. Who would have thought those two things would go together? But don't get him started on the acting work of Jessica Chastain, otherwise you'll go into a different line entirely. Richard Fitzwilliams, Natasha Armstrong, Katie Grimerson, Georgia Scotta de Risotto. Many thanks indeed. And of course, Robin Pierce, take care. We'll see you all again very soon. Keep watching those movies.
It's supercalifragilisticexpialidocious. Even though the sound of it is something quite atrocious, if you say it loud enough, you'll always sound precocious. Supercalifragilisticexpialidocious.
Because I was afraid to speak when I was just a lad, my father gave me nails a tweak and told me I was bad. But then one day I learned a word to say me aching nose,
the biggest word you ever heard, and this is how it goes. Oh, supercalifragilisticexpialidocious. Even though the sound of it is something quite atrocious, if you say it loud enough, you'll always sound precocious. Supercalifragilisticexpialidocious. He travelled all around the world, and everywhere he went, he'd use his word and all would say, there goes a clever gent.
When Dukes and Martha Rogers pass a time of day with me, I say me special word and leave me off me out to tea.
Woo! Supercalifragilisticexpialidocious. Even though the sound of it is something quite atrocious, if you say it loud enough, you'll always sound precocious.
Docious alley, expiistic, fragicali rufus. But that's going a bit too far, don't you think?
Indubitably.
So when the cat has got your tongue, there's no need for dismay. Just summon up this word and then you've got a lot to say. But better use it carefully or it could change your life.
For example?
Yes?
One night I said it to me girl, and now me girl's me wife. Oh, and a lovely thing she is too.
Supercalifragilisticexpialidocious. Supercalifragilisticexpialidocious. Supercalifragilisticexpialidocious.
Well, I've just returned from a level 2 session of Histories of Journalism, in which I quizzed all my students on whether they were suffering from decision paralysis and whether they'd actually take this opportunity to go out and actually vary their restaurant choice. And perhaps, unfortunately, 80% of them said they're just going to stick with the restaurants that they already know. This cannot be the case. Let's find out why we are a nation of repeaters with two fabulous individuals. First of all, it's always a delight to welcome back to the Midweek Drive the awesome regional managing director at The Fork. That's a wonderful Patrick Hoikas. How are you, Patrick?
Good morning. I'm very well, thank you.
Excellent. And indeed, putting some of the science behind this and maybe why we could be suffering from decision paralysis, it's the awesome psychologist, Professor Charles Spence. How are you, Charles?
Very well, thank you.
Excellent. Charles, let's come to you first. Is this something that's just British? I mean, that's what we do. We like our traditional pubs. We like our restaurant. Why do we change? You know, were the 18 and 19-year-olds I've just been teaching, were they also just following that pattern?
So I think we differ as individuals. Sort of through psychology says some people are more prone, tempted to try out, search out the experimental, exploratory, the different, the foreign, the new cuisine, the new fusion food, and others less so. But I think really we have to look at the pandemic that we are hopefully now finally coming out of. And what I see, and I've sort of noticed it over the last 2 years, is how when the the world looks like a dangerous place and our place in it uncertain, we're not sure what's going on, what's going to happen, then in those situations of uncertainty, we kind of move towards comfort foods, towards nostalgia brands, towards familiar foods and choices, going for what we know, there'll be no surprises, but also no experimentation and nothing new. But we sort of seek reassurance almost then in our food choices. And what's come out from the Fork Festival survey of 2,000 Brits is that now that we are starting to come out, there are more than a quarter of us who sort of recognise, almost bore ourselves with our narrow range of food choices and want to do something different. And yet, for whatever reason, we just don't. We end up going back to what we know and are familiar with. And maybe that's, as you mentioned, partly down to this choice paralysis, that if we're given too many choices, too many options on a menu, too many restaurants to choose between, then we'll do some research, but perhaps just end up giving up hope and going back to not having to make the choice is the easiest thing to do. And also people worry a bit about price too. And that's where I think the Fork Festival, starting today with 50% off the sort of food at the participating restaurants, helps to remove at least one of the major concerns that people have when they think about going somewhere new and choosing something different to surprise their taste buds.
I mean, it's fair to say, Patrick, when I did mention that there could well be up to 50% off, the students' eyes sort of lit up, basically. They thought, oh, we might actually engage with this. So maybe we are going down that line. I don't know. It could be a different thing. But do you, Patrick, from your own background, which I believe is Dutch, do you tend to actually turn around and say, those Brits, honestly, they should just take more from the notion of the Buddhist theory that where there is choice, there is misery. It's not appropriate for this aspect.
No, well, to be fair, Alex, is that we also see it a little bit in the other countries. It is not only UK. I think it's human nature to go for the ordinary, to go for something that you know. If you go out for a dinner, you want to have a great experience. And certainly now, after the pandemic, people go out a little bit less and they want to be 100% sure that they are going to a place and have a great experience. So it's then a little bit normal to go back to what you know. So that is also why we have the Fork Festival now. We have it in all European countries where we are active. And we give the our diners, normally we give them the possibility to go on our app, to download the app, to go on our website and select a nice restaurant based on pictures, based on reviews, based on menu. But now we think it is even more important with the festival to give them a little bit of a nudge, a little bit of something. You know what? Why don't you try something differently? Why don't you go and with a limited risk? Because with a 50% off of the food, I think the risk is very limited. I think you should go out a little bit more and try some new places. And that's why we have the Fork Festival with hundreds of restaurants in the UK. And it starts today. It starts for the next four and it continues for the next 6 weeks. So I think our diners and our future diners have a great possibility to go out again.
All the way up to November the 28th.
Have a new experience. Sorry, Alex?
All the way up to November the 28th.
All the way to November 28th, 6 weeks.
Charles, nudge theory, of course, well beloved with respect to psychologists and presumably also public relations specialists from that point of view. Do you also think that slight kind of notion of putting more colour and flavour back to your beige life, which again, I used that line and I could tell that it was raising the ire of one or two of my students, the beige lives, what's going on here?
I think people, the way we view ourselves. I mean, I think from the results of the survey, it's clear that, you know, many people do recognise they want to have more choice, but they realise they're not. They've got into a rut. They are the repeaters, as you mentioned. So in that sense, we acknowledge that things aren't perfect at the moment and that we can take this opportunity as we come out of the lockdown to try some new experiences. Things that, you know, for many of us before the pandemic, a quarter of Brits when surveyed were choosing their holiday destinations based on the food, the exotic food they expected to be able to try there. And that's something that's been denied to most of us for a couple of years now. And yet, with it, we know with all the choice of restaurants that many of us are lucky enough to find sort of close to where we live, that's going to be a great opportunity to try those new experiences. I think there's probably nothing better than food, really. And you know, all the new experiences we could have, we could go and see a new museum or listen to a new kind of music or whatever it is, I think the food is one that's most accessible in a way. And while we do fear what happens if we get it wrong, and some of the anecdotal reports from the survey, you know, it's worse than meeting the mothers, the parents-in-law for the first time.
And just imagine if you took your in-laws to a new restaurant, it could be a complete nightmare.
Yes, yes. So certainly we find, you know, from our research we've been running in parts of Asia, that we, you know, people are more likely to try something new when they're with their friends rather than on a romantic dinner or with their family, and probably were more likely to try something new also, I think, towards the later part of the day. But what interests me as a food psychologist is how, you know, breakfast, we're very happy to eat the same thing day in, day out, month in, month out, whereas doing that for dinner, we're a bit less pleased about it. So later in the day, we seem more open to experiment, to try something new, and hence where the Fork Festival, I think, fits in.
Patrick, let's provide some more details about how people can access the Fork restaurants and indeed take part in this awesome festival. Where would you suggest they should go to, Patrick?
We've spoken about this before, and I'm almost sure that most of your audience have already gone to the fork.co.uk.
Yeah, but there's always one or two who don't, you see, even in LinkedIn.
Yes,
there's always
and, one I, two and that's why don't. I'm really happy to repeat the answer. Thank you for that, Alex. So please go to the fork.co.uk. Go to the shop to download the apps, either Apple or Android, and explore new restaurants based on pictures, based on reviews, based on a menu. But now, for the next 6 weeks, also do it based on pricing. Ensure that you can have a new experience at a 50% off food. And I believe that we can help also the restaurants in this way, to who are ready to receive them, to receive their existing clientele, but also to receive new visitors and new guests. And I think that will help both areas, the restaurateurs and also the diners.
And Charles, will you be stepping out of beige eating habits? Or okay, so of course not. I always step out. My whole culinary life is one of constant experimentation.
Yeah, so I'm always looking forward to the new and to the different, be that in different kinds of cuisine, but also I'm really interested in sort of the new fusion foods that are coming out, where you know, different things that we're familiar with are sort of brought together, the mufgul or the cronut, as another example, through to, you know, all the new kinds of foods you might be eating sometime in the near future, be it bugs or who knows what else, more plant-based proteins.
Well, it was the late Professor Magnus Pike who I think was very much a proponent of fried locusts. I've never managed to quite follow that one through, but, you know, that was his way. he meant that they were very crispy, I believe. Anyway, mm-hmm. It's part and parcel of the whole thing. For the moment, Professor Charles Spence, a psychologist, and of course, Regional Managing Director at the Fork, that's Patrick Hoijkaas. Did I get the pronunciation right, Patrick? I'm never quite sure whether the Dutch is actually
you
there.
Did it. Alex, you did it fantastic. Let me say it, because then the people recognize that you did it fantastic. It's Hoijkaas, but you did it great. So very happy for that.
Excellent. Well, Patrick Hoijkaas and Charles Spence, huge thanks. And hopefully we'll speak again in the not too distant future.
Definitely. Thank you very much for having us.